massive high-temperature disk. At this point, a huge amount of electromagnetic energy is radiated, mostly in the form of, or a large amount of radiated in the form of gamma rays, lasting on the order of 10 to the 3 milliseconds at least. So numerical relativity codes are not yet capable of doing simulations on the order of 10 to the 3 milliseconds for black hole neutron stars in full general relativity, and B, able to emulate or to simulate the physics, the necessary physics to better understand this disk and thus reproduce a short hard gamma ray burst on the computer. So what is being studied these days is the short hard gamma ray burst engine phase, the late in spiral through merger, and answer the question, how big of a disk do you get on a dynamical time scale after the merger? So what parameters are important that we need to consider for black hole neutron star mergers in terms of how much disk mass we might get? Well, tidal disruption, on a back of the envelope kind of way, occurs when the gravitational force at the neutron star surface balances the black hole tidal force. Now, as long as this occurs far enough from the black hole, you expect, perhaps, to get a disk. So we're looking at this inequality here. D is greater than the ISCO radius of the black hole, the innermost stable circular orbit. And we can rearrange this expression by defining a couple of quantities first. The compaction of the neutron star, the black hole to neutron star mass ratio, and we get D over mass of a black hole, a dimensionless quantity, goes like Q to the minus 2/3 C to the minus 1. So basically, naively speaking, we would expect that keeping all else fixed, as you decrease the mass ratio closer to 1, you would get more disk. Similarly, if you make the neutron star puffier, that is, you reduce its compaction, you expect it to tidally disrupt farther from the black hole, thus producing perhaps a larger disk. Now, these are not the only important parameters, as we'll see. If you look at test particles around moving along geodesics around a Kerr black hole, you'll see that the ISCO radius of the black hole decreases as the spin component of the black hole aligned with the orbital angular momentum increases. So in other words, you expect more disk as the aligned spin increases. So this is just a simple example of what's done. So basically, you start with the same system. You vary, for example, the spin parameter of the black hole. In this case, the Illinois group varied it from minus 0.5 counter-aligned with the orbital angular momentum, 0, up to spin parameter of 0.75. I could give an entire talk, of course, on black hole neutron star initial data because there's a lot to talk about. But I'm going to focus on evolutions in this talk, so I will simply keep it simple. So conformal thin sandwich is one way of generating initial data for black hole neutron star used by three of the four groups. And puncture initial data is used, is a puncture approach to generating black hole neutron star initial data by the Japanese group. And general, so the ultimate goal of these initial data is to realistically model a black hole neutron star at small separations, very close to merger. And we'll see how well they do in a few minutes. So general parameters that are chosen. Now, for the binary black hole case, we all know what the kind of default parameters, the first parameters that were studied. You're talking about Q equals 1, the 1-to-1 mass ratio. We're talking zero spin. So the default case for black hole neutron star, on the other hand, is a 3-to-1 mass ratio, where the black hole is 3 times as massive as the neutron star, and black hole spin parameter 0. Now, I got to point out that according to population synthesis models, 7-to-1 seems to be more preferred, that is a higher mass ratio than what we simulate by default. In terms of neutron star, the default case is an irrotational neutron star with a gamma equals 2 polytropic equation of state. Now, the reason we use an irrotational neutron star is because we know the tidal locking time for this binary is much longer than the in-spiral time scale. So now we have our black hole neutron star initial data. Next step, evolve it. So there's a different code designed to do just this for every group. You have two basic sets of equations. You have your gravitational field sector, and you have your fluid dynamic sector. Gravitational fields, of course, we're solving Einstein's equations. Two groups solve it in the generalized harmonic formalism, and two groups solve it in the Baumgart-Shapiro-Shibata-Nakamura formalism. The fluid equations are simply the equations of general relativistic hydrodynamics, and a couple of groups so far have introduced magnetic fields into their evolution schemes through using the MHD approximation. The Chal et al. Group and the Illinois group, of which I'm a member, I'll tell you that's in progress. There are no publications yet. A brief word about the algorithms that are used. This is an important distinction between these codes. So time evolution, however, the time evolution is handled via finite differencing schemes for all codes. Einstein's equations for the metric, three of the four groups use finite difference approaches to approximate the finite difference, the derivatives in Einstein's equations. The Cornell group, on the other hand, uses a pseudo-spectral multi-domain technique for evaluating the gravitational fields. We've all heard about the SPECT code. Coordinates are handled via one of two techniques, the puncture gauge conditions or generalized harmonic coordinate conditions. Now, the goal of the coordinates systems is to avoid the black hole physical singularity. The puncture coordinates avoid it by construction, basically. So and it leads to long-term stability, as we know from binary black hole simulations. Generalized harmonic coordinates, on the other hand, use an excision surface inside the black hole. Basically, it's a boundary condition set inside the black hole so that one does not have to evolve deep inside the black hole. General relativistic and hydrodynamics and MHD equations are solved via conservative, high-resolution shot capturing schemes, where the reconstruction is second or third order accurate for smooth flows. Of course, if there are a lot of shocks, one can only expect first order accuracy there. And what we find is, this is a nearly universal statement, is that the reconstruction scheme in the hydrodynamics sets the order at which our black hole neutron star simulations are accurate. So even though we have, some of us have spectral grids and spectral convergence in our fields, we can't expect spectral convergence whenever we add hydrodynamics to it. In fact, the Cornell group gets second order convergence for their waveforms, for example. Now, whenever adding MHD to the code, you add an extra complication. Whenever you evolve a magnetic configuration, if it has initially zero divergence on the B fields, truncation error will allow it to increase if you don't do anything special with time. So what is done is something called hyperbolic divergence cleaning by the Chola et al. The Illinois group is developing a different technique, as well as at least one other group in the world, maybe perhaps two other groups. Including the Japanese group and Bruno's group. So Chala et al., Illinois and Japan, all use an AMR infrastructure for their grids. Now, this is a very important consideration whenever we look at the errors of these simulations. On the other hand, Cornell uses a multi-domain spectral grid coupled to a uniform resolution hydrodynamics grid. Now, the best way to show what I mean by this grid structure is first to show you kind of what a multi-domain grid might look like and show you a quick movie of what the fluid grids do over time. So here we have a very interesting case. This has not been published in the literature. However, it has been published on their website. This is a first processing case that I've seen. It's a black hole spin of 0.5, 80 degrees inclined to the orbital angular momentum, 3-to-1 mass ratio. They don't mention the equation of state on their website. However, they end up with a 3% disk, that is 3% of the initial neutron star mass ends up in a, as a disk around the black hole at the end of the simulation. Now, this is less disk than if one were to perform the same case, but with perfectly aligned black hole spin. And this is exactly as we expected from our back of the envelope calculation. The final spin is 20 degrees inclined to the orbital angular momentum. And so there is some alignment of the black hole spin taking place during this evolution. Okay, so let me get to a good spot. Okay, great. So this gray box right here is the neutron star fluid grid. So this is the hydrodynamics grid. This is a uniform resolution grid on the initial orbital plane. So it's projected onto the initial orbital plane. So you'll see it expand as the neutron star tidally disrupts and basically become lower resolution. This is a neutron star, for those of you who don't realize. This is a black hole. These are the densities. So you see it bobs. And we end up with a nice tidal tail, which forms a sort of disc-like structure near the end of the simulation. And I'll show this movie again. In case you, because there are two frames here. Whoosh. Great. Outstanding. All right. And I'll just note really quickly, the density scales, in case you didn't notice, varied with time. So we don't have a large amount of disk outside the neutron star. So how can you believe our results? This is an excellent question. Because in some cases, there are discrepancies between our codes. When we perform basically the same evolution, we find slightly different results. So I'm going to go over what the Illinois group has done, at least, since I had these slides available, in terms of code validation tests. I will also review what other groups do, which is very similar. So there are three basic types of code tests one could perform. One, a test against an analytic solution. Make sure your code converges to that at the expected order. Second, there are external code tests, tests against other codes. Do the same simulation and see if you get the same result. If not, try and figure out why. Finally, there are internal code tests. One can measure the total energy radiated from the system by gravitational waves and also measure the total energy of the system versus time. Putting those two things together, you can get a measure of how much energy is spuriously lost in your simulation. The same thing can be done for angular momentum, as well as rest mass, convergence tests. So all those are sort of internal code validation checks. So before the Illinois group added AMR capabilities to our code, we performed a series of non-AMR code validation tests, including shock tube tests, as you might expect, Oppenheimer-Schneider collapse, Bondi flow, as well as tests against other codes where we performed a magnetized hypermassive neutron star simulation using the same initial data as the Japanese group, and we found good agreement. Once we added adaptive mesh refinement capabilities, we wanted to make sure that we had properly embedded it into the infrastructure provided, in this case, by Carpet. So what we did was we performed a binary black hole simulation with both equal and unequal mass, seven and five orbits respectively. And what we did was we compared our final result against those found in the literature. For example, the final black hole spin, the kick velocity. So what we found is better than a percent agreement. We also performed these internal code checks where we measure the fraction of the total energy that is spuriously lost in our simulation. I don't know of many other groups that are doing this in the binary black hole community, but I'd love to see it in more papers. So, for example, delta E is of order 10 to the minus 4, and delta J is of order 10 to the minus 3. And I'll just, for completeness, delta E is the initial ADM mass minus the final ADM mass, taking into account the amount that's been radiated away in gravitational waves, all normalized by the initial ADM mass. Now, we trust our field sector. We get very good agreement with other codes for binary black holes, which is a very harsh code test. Next, we worry about matter, our hydrodynamic scheme that's been embedded into the AMR infrastructure. So here's a picture of a typical BHNS during the merger phase. Now you can see there are boxes here. Those are refinement boxes. The blue boxes are resolution delta X. The green boxes are resolution 2 delta X. And what we see is matter from the neutron star escaping this refinement box, going into lower resolution and back into higher resolution before being accreted into the black hole. Now we worry because our hydrodynamic scheme guarantees that we conserve rest mass except when matter crosses refinement boundaries. We don't know how much error we get. So our goal here is to measure how much error we get from this. So we devised an evil code test. We have an equilibrium, rapidly rotating neutron star. We have a delta X resolution box inside the star. You're looking, so the spin component of the neutron star is out of the page here. We have a resolution box, a 2 delta X, that straddles the neutron star, and finally 4 delta X outside. And what we do is, to ensure that matter is crossing refinement boundaries at all times, we move these boxes around the neutron star. And what we find is, yes, rest mass does get violated, but its error converges to zero at better than second order in our simulations. And in fact, whenever we perform a full BHNS simulation, our rest mass violation is much lower than any of this. It's of order 10 to the minus 4. In other words, 0.1% of 1%. Another question we can ask, this is a very important question as well, is how does the density profile of the neutron star change versus time after you've moved this refinement box around it for a good while? Seven rotation periods of the neutron star. And the answer is it hasn't changed much. So this gives us more confidence that this is not that important. So another issue that we realized is that our initial data imposes a helical killing vector in an approximation to Einstein's equations that it solves. Now, we know, so this assumes basically that the initial data is circular. Now, this is not physically true, especially as you get to smaller separations, when the radial infall velocity increases. So the question is, how close start our initial configuration and still maintain accuracy, but we don't want to start from extremely large separations because we simply don't have the computational resources. So it's kind of a give and take here. So what I'm showing here is the rest mass fraction of the neutron star outside the apparent horizon versus time, as shifted by T25, the time at which 25% of the neutron star matter has been accreted into the apparent horizon. And what we find is, for our small separation case, we get a physically inconsistent result. That's this red line down here. We get compared to the medium and large separation cases. Now, our default BHNS simulation is a large separation case, in part because we want to have a longer waveform. So speaking of waveforms, here is the Newman-Penrose Weil scalar versus time, again shifted by this T25 for both the large and medium separation cases. And as you can see, there's really good agreement between these two waveforms. Finally, an internal code check. Black hole neutron star convergence. This is a very important code check, and we pass it to second order. So in other words, our black hole neutron star waveforms converge to second order. We also look at internal checks of consistency. This delta E parameter, the fraction of energy that's lost spuriously during an evolution, is of order 10 to the minus 4. Delta J is of order 1%. It's about 1%, actually. So other groups do very similar things. They perform convergence tests. The Japanese group, for example, they find rest mass violation convergence for binary neutron star converges to second order. Black hole neutron star, they find second order convergence in their results as well. self-consistency checks. They look at their own measure of J and E conservation, and it's very comparable, at least the delta J is comparable to those of Illinois group. Cornell group looks at, that performs convergence tests as well. Their field sector has been well tested using binary black holes, we all know. The matter sector, they perform single neutron star in equilibrium, also neutron star collapse, initial density perturbations, an initial pressure depletion in the neutron star, and check that the physical results are consistent with what we expect, with what one would expect. And they also find second order convergence in their BHNS results. Now, self-consistency, J and E conservation, they also look at that. Now, the Chawla et al. Group, this six university collaboration, they have in the past evolved a TOV star on a uniform resolution grid, get 2.4 fourth order convergence, spherical accretion onto stationary Schwarzschild black hole. They find that it converges to the analytic solution as more levels of refinement are added. AMR spherical blast wave. They find that hyperbolic divergence cleaning, this is a magnetized case, improves the constraint violation for DIV-B. And they have not yet published convergence for their black hole neutron star. So on to the results. So here is a basic overview of all the studies that have been performed. Now, a study means try to keep everything else fixed, varying only one parameter. Illinois group so far has been the only one to perform and publish a black hole spin study. Mass ratio study has been performed by two groups, neutron star compaction study by two groups. Equation of state, only Cornell has performed this test. And magnetic field so far, only Chawla et al. have published results on that. First, the mass ratio study. These are Illinois results here. And we found something pretty interesting. So here's again the accretion plot, rest mass fraction outside of the apparent horizon versus T minus T25. And you see, notice that the final disk mass is not a monotonic function of the initial mass ratio of the system, the black hole to neutron star mass ratio. This is not what we expected initially, but if you look at the complicated dynamics of the one-to-one case with a large amount of shock heating, you might understand a little better what's going on. So here's a multi-group comparison. So looking at the same neutron star compaction, the same equation of state, varying only the neutron star mass ratio. Now, these are some pretty interesting results, because the Illinois and Japan groups get an inconsistent result when doing the same case for the final disk mass. So the final disk mass, maybe to understand this, we need to look at the total energy in the disk. It's about 4% the neutron star rest mass at maximum, see? The Japanese group finds of order less than 10 to the minus 5. In other words, 10 to the minus 3%. Of course, these are upper bounds on disk mass, but we evolved to the same amount of time after merger. So these should agree, ideally. But the problem is, perhaps, we have both groups have energy and angular momentum that's spuriously lost in these simulations. Energy, Illinois group, sees 0.01% loss of energy in the simulation. Japanese group, 1%. Illinois and the Japanese group both see the spurious angular momentum loss of order 1 to 2%. Now compare that to the total energy in the disk, for example, these energies, for example, and you'll see that 4% of the neutron star rest mass is a 3-to-1 case. This is about 1% the total energy of the system is outside the black hole at the end. So, can I say that we know that we can do black hole neutron star simulations and get a disk to within a percent of the total initial energy? Probably not. This is a very difficult problem. Our codes only converge to second order. We don't have the beautiful high order convergence of the binary black holes, and it might not be possible, to be honest, given that we have to use hydrodynamics. So I'd like you to focus on this right plot here. These, of course, are time series waveforms. The right plot here shows the frequency space waveform. So basically, these are Illinois group data. I haven't yet seen another group put the advanced LIGO noise curve on top of their numerical data. So what we're trying to answer here is, assuming that a binary black hole neutron star has merged 100 megaparsecs away, we're trying to answer two questions. One, is it detectable by advanced LIGO? And two, will it be distinguishable from a binary black hole noise curve or signal curve? And the answer to the first question is, yes, it looks like it's detectable. You can see the black solid line agrees, of course, with black hole, the red dashed line, up to high frequencies. However, distinguishing between BHNS and BHBH doesn't look like it's going to be possible with this sort of tuning for the advanced LIGO. It might be possible for different configurations of the instrument. However, for this case, it doesn't seem likely. And by the way, we get our low frequency stuff by pasting on a post-Newtonian waveform to the beginning of our numerical waveforms. Next, I'm going to show a movie. I think this is a pretty exciting movie, of the Illinois Group's black hole spin study. Now, we have three cases that you're going to see here. We have our 3-to-1 mass ratio study with spin anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. We have our spin zero case and spin 0.75 case aligned with the orbital angular momentum. Now, remember what we expect. The ISCA radius of the black hole shrinks as we increase the aligned spin. So we expect almost no disk, more disk, and more disk. Okay. So everything else is the same in this simulation, including the initial orbital frequency, the initial mass ratio. We're basically dealing with the same system except for the black hole spin. So this is three movies in one. So you can see exactly what effect black hole spin has. Okay, so first you're going to see case C, our anti-aligned case, merge, just as we would expect. The black hole spin component is pointing into the projector there. And we get almost no disk in that case. Next, case A comes up. We get this big tidal tail, a lot of shock heating in this region right here. And finally, the most interesting case, this highly spinning case B, we get this enormous tidal tail that comes out from the simulation. And we end up with a 15% disk, which is pretty impressive. Now, notice at the end of our simulation, we have kind of a clearing out region inside the black hole, just outside the black hole. And this indicates the presence of an ISCO. And you'll see it appear here as well in just a second. There we go. Okay. So let's look at this case in just a little bit more detail. Here's the accretion rate plot. So rest mass fraction outside the apparent horizon versus time, again shifted by the time at which 25% of the neutron star rest mass is inside the horizon. And you can see that the 0.75 case is well above the zero and negative 0.5 cases. This indicates that the black hole spin may play a very important role in determining, answering the question, can black hole neutron stars produce short hard gamma ray bursts? Next, equation of state versus disk mass and waveform effects by the Cornell group. So in these simulations, they try to keep the neutron star compaction as close to constant as possible, varying only the equation of state. So they start with a gamma equals 2. They do a more realistic nuclear theory-based equation of state called the Shun equation of state. Finally, they choose a gamma equals 2.75 case. And notice that, first of all, the final disk mass for the two gamma equals 2 and the Shun equations of state almost agree. they say this is because the Schoen equation of state is very similar to the gamma equals 2 in lower density regions. Now, the gamma equals 2.75 case, on the other hand, you get a much bigger disk mass. This is because that what they see is a huge tidal tail coming off from the neutron star when it gets tidally disrupted. And this is a gravitational wave spectrum from the three different cases I have listed here, as well as an additional case with a higher compaction. We'll see the compaction effects in the next slide. But I'm sure you can imagine, as you increase the compaction, you get more you get more signal at the higher frequencies. And also notice that the Schoen and the gamma equals 2 equations of state power spectra overlap pretty well. Okay, next, neutron star compaction effects. So there are two groups that have really looked at this in good detail, the Cornell group as well as the Japanese group. Now, they choose different mass ratios, different equations of state, and different black hole spins. However, keeping those fixed, they vary the neutron star compaction. What they find is pretty interesting, but not unexpected. As the neutron star gets puffier, as its compaction decreases, you get more of a disk. Okay. So finally, briefly, the results that were just put on the archive last week from Chola et al. This is a group consisting of LSU, BYU, IU, Perimeter Institute, University of Guelph, and University of Long Island. So here they choose a slightly more physically realistic case in terms of mass ratio, at least, 5 to 1. The neutron star compaction, however, is a lot lower than what other groups have chosen. The equation of state is the default that's been used in the past. The black hole spin they set to 0.5. And they basically only vary the initial maximum magnetic field strength. And to get an idea of what type of magnetic fields they use, I encourage you to take a look at their paper. The bottom line is they don't find a significant effect from magnetic fields, at least for this strength magnetic field. And if you look very closely at this plot right here, you can see magnetic field lines on this neutron star density isosurface after merger. And this big black dot, of course, is a black hole. And here you can see some snapshots from their evolution. So what do we need to do in the future? I think it would be, I think pretty much the field would agree that we need to incorporate more physics to better model the disk at the end of the simulation and thus perhaps reproduce a gamma ray burst if black hole neutron stars in fact can produce gamma ray bursts. This is going to require adding neutrino radiation and electromagnetic radiation capabilities into the codes. Next, in order to do this, the software needs to be improved. Long-term disk evolution, we're talking of order 100 times at least the current length of the simulation that's been performed. So it may be necessary to implement an implicit time-stepping scheme, for example. And finally, we need to work more on better understanding discrepancies between our codes and maybe get some idea of how we can reduce our errors in these simulations. In other words, it might be useful to have an apples-to-apples type test for a GRMHD. So that's about 40 minutes. Thank you.
Your last slides when you were showing the effect of keeping the compactness the same but then varying the equation of state.
Yes,
and I was just wondering how well can you actually maintain the compactness? I mean, can you tune it so they're the same to the third significant digit? Because you were showing that if you vary the compactness, you get.
Well, if you vary the compactness, now notice the variations here are, 20% or so. I mean, the variations here are, we're talking less than a percent in these cases. So,
but it just happens to be monotonic in that variation.
I don't know exactly how they generated their initial data, but it may have just been difficult to zero in on exactly the same compaction on for those three cases. So,
any other questions?
So at the start you said sort of from population synthesis that a 7-to-1 kind of mass ratio is probably what would be expected, which I guess is 1.35 with about a 10 mm-hmm. solar mass black hole.
Right.
I don't think I saw a simulation where that's been done.
True. The biggest mass ratio that I've seen in the literature is 5-to-1. Now, the idea is we want to also study these. The thing is, there's at least one group, the Japanese group, haven't yet published anything with black hole spin. So it's known that black hole spin is going to play an important role. At least now it's known. Doing a 7-to-1 case, you're unlikely, I think, to get any kind of spin. Any significant disk, if you were to not have black hole spin also incorporated. Now, this is definitely a piece of work that's in our future to do this more realistically based on what population synthesis people tend to be driving us toward in terms of physical realism. So,
what's the challenge? What makes it hard to do that 7-to-1?
So, okay, the 5-to-1 case, you have, at least in our gauge, basically the same coordinate size between black hole and neutron star. Now, the Illinois group has done a 1-to-1 case, although it's very expensive because the black hole is, I'll show you, here's what the initial, oops, I'm going the wrong way. The initial data look like, here we go, look like this. So this is actually the biggest difference. I honestly don't think that there is a really significant technological challenge facing us for doing the 7-to-1 mass ratio, because, like I said, 5-to-1, the black hole size expands the coordinate size on the grid, and that's really what you need to consider when you're doing a numerical evolution: the physical size on your grid, the amount of resolution you need. That sets the Coron factor, et cetera. So.
You may have said this, but I missed it. For the Illinois code,
yes.
What is the order of differencing for the space-time? Is that, so I know your hydro is second
you,
order.
You mean for the gravitational fields?
Yeah.
Yeah. We use a fourth order.
Okay.
Yes.
And the follow-up is why, can you give any sense for why the waveforms are second order convergence?
Because the hydrodynamics, the reconstruction of the hydrodynamics is second order.
Right. So if you go to more extreme mass ratios, do you see better convergence? Like at some point, the hydro should matter less, right?
That's an interesting question, actually. Maybe. But the thing is, the waveform comes from both objects moving. I mean, the bulk motion of both objects. So I wouldn't expect there to be a lot of improvement from a 7-to-1 case, for example. But we have yet to test that. That's a good point.
Any other questions?
Can I ask one more, which is similar to what I asked Jocelyn this morning? If I want to search for black hole neutron stars, am I okay using post-Newtonian expansion up to approximately ISCO, or is there evidence that we need something more? I mean, it'd be great to have the merger in, but mm-hmm. you know, what should we
be using? I think you can take what's been learned from binary black hole and apply it here. So that's the bottom line.
So, I mean, to some degree, I agree with Zach, but we have to be a bit more careful, because in the case of the black hole neutron star, Yes, indeed, as you're getting closer to the East Coast, that's when you might expect to see differences. But actually, one has to remember that the neutron star is a fat object. So you could have the outskirts or the inner edge of the star begin to touch the East Coast, even though when its central region is still far out. And that begins to leave its imprint. So it could be that actually we don't, depending on the mass ratio and the equation of state, we're not able to push it all the way to the East Coast. On the other hand, well, it's going to depend on the mass of the black hole. So if the black hole is sufficiently low, say it has four solar masses or something, well, the merger will take place past the bucket of LIGO, and well, you don't have to worry that much. But if we're beginning to play the game where we believe that black holes of 20, 30 solar masses are there, and this is what most of the binaries will have, then we're going to be in a deeper trouble.
I actually have a question about the spin. So it seems that spin is very important in the formation of the gamma ray bursts. And spin is something that I think LIGO and Virgo don't do particularly well in their searches at the moment.
Right.
The take-home message seems to be we worry about spin anyway, but we should particularly worry for these systems. Mm-hmm. The question is, most of the simulations you showed are aligned spins. There's no precession in here. Is that because you think that accretion will act to align the spins and then the black hole goes off first, the neutron star supernova doesn't kick it much, or just for simplicity that you do the aligned spins first and worry about precession later?
Okay, using a Dick Cheney-ism, we go to war with the initial data we have, not the initial data we want. So we didn't yet, so the Illinois group I can speak for, we didn't yet have non-aligned spins for black hole capabilities in our initial data software. So that's why we didn't have that. The Cornell Caltech group, on the other hand, they do have that capability, and hopefully we'll be seeing a paper from them soon discussing more of the effects of precession.
Okay, I understand that, I mean, the signal, the gravitational wave signal can be very different from the black hole pair if there is, I don't know, an accretion disk of, if the neutron star undergoes some dramatic thing like, I don't know, breakage.
Tidal disruption.
Because of tidal. But if it's just the fatness of the neutron star we are worried about, can't I invoke the effacement principle and say that all of these are 5PN effects? And if it's just the finite size, I mean, that bothers me. That should be a 5PN effect, shouldn't it?
Right, right. Finite size effects, right. So, so you see, I mean, if you look at this curve, for example, I mean, sure, we're pasting on to post-Newtonian. We're not entirely sure what the error is by just assuming post-Newtonian when we're matching on. But you can see this most significant deviation occurring at really high frequencies, and that's when you get to these finite size effects actually really take hold. And you might learn a lot about the neutron star equation of state, for example, by actually observing a signal in these high frequency bands. So,
but that's really close to the East Coast, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the idea is the neutron star is, yeah. Yep.
At least for our Cornell Caltech black hole neutron star in spirals, we really haven't started with a large enough separation to start answering these questions about matching post-Newtonian and effacement and so on. So we've mainly been concentrating on getting just a couple orbits and getting through the merger or the disruption merger phase. And I think a goal in the next couple years will be to push the end spirals longer to start answering questions like this.
Absolutely.
This is actually just a point of my own ignorance, and Duncan may be the best to answer this. When you plot this frequency across the strain curve, is that including match template filtering? Is that including the SNR penalty for the integration and everything, or is it just the spectrum?
Right. I'll refer you to our paper that where we give the reference for this. I could look through my paper right now, but I don't think that'd be great. So I'll simply stick it right here. If you look here, we have a reference to where we get our power, our noise curve.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean the noise curve. I meant actually the spectrum of signal that you have put over the noise curve.
Oh, right, right.
Does that include...
It's 2.5 post-Newtonian order.
Is that just the frequency spectrum of the waveform, or is
yes,
that
Yes, it's a
the,
frequency spectrum. We get it from, I believe, a paper from Ajith et al.
So there's another factor of F to the 5 halves or something in that when it comes to an SNR?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't the one that worked
That's
out all the subtleties
question.
Here, but...
well, typically, yeah. I mean, this is basically the power spectrum of the system scaled to be 100 megaparsecs. I mean, for neutron star, black hole, 100 megaparsecs is pretty loud in advanced LIGO. I haven't seen this paper, so I can't comment definitively, but when we've plotted this type of thing in the past, in the paper we wrote with Lana and Mike, where we did this for black hole systems, we basically plot, you know, the noise curve in amplitude spectral density and then the Fourier transform of the wave function, so it's signal with signal. You're basically assuming you know the signal perfectly, and then that's where it would appear on the noise curve.
The fact that low SNR matters more because in terms of a detectability, because you're sitting there in spiraling.
It is. Yeah. Any more questions? Actually, one thing, I have another follow-up question. So it looks like, you know, we need to start worrying about similar studies here for, as Jocelyn was talking about this morning, for black hole neutron star, because when we measure things in LIGO, we measure the chirp mass, and we don't get the mass ratio very well. So to distinguish between a black hole, and a neutron star black hole binary, we might need to start worrying about narrow banding and seeing what's going on at the end of the signal and...
Absolutely.
Not just assuming that we can easily distinguish between black hole, and black hole neutron star without an electromagnetic signature.
Right, especially if the natural neutron star compaction is not much less than this. So
this is another argument for narrow banding or ET or something that can really probe this merger region.
Absolutely.
I suspect this is with the neutron star detection optimized configuration. So if you put in something like the high power detuned broadband kind of thing, you might actually get a noticeably better kind of resolution of that end point.
Just one point along the lines of what Duncan was just saying. I don't think anybody's looked at this yet, but one interesting possibility as far as the mass ratio. With the in spiral, everything scales with the chirp mass, and you get, you know, no information from the mass ratio. But at least in the black hole binary case, in the merger, everything is scaling with the total mass. And is fairly surprisingly independent of the mass ratio. So you have two different degeneracies with mass ratio in the two phases. So I imagine if you do things coherently, you'll get a lot more information about mass ratio than you do with either one separately. So but to my knowledge, nobody has actually demonstrated that yet. But I would like to, or to see someone else do it.
From an instrumental perspective, it means, you know, we need to make sure we see that merger. If this is happening, you know, if it's an 8 solar mass, 1.4 solar mass, which probably would exist for this type of stuff in population synthesis, we need to make sure. I think that's higher than the bucket. Any other questions?
How important are these tidal effects Jocelyn was talking about this morning for black hole neutron star binaries? So the tidal deformation of the neutron star during the last 10, 20, 50, 100 orbits.
So you're asking about finite size effects 15 orbits out, right? well, I can't say anything because we haven't performed that long, that long of a simulation, but we hope to in the future, of course.
I can say something about that. In the case where you have a larger mass ratio, so in the one-to-one case, things are about half as important because the black hole has, in this leading order of phase contribution, an identically zero term. And as soon as you get going into the unequal mass case, the mass scale of the system really suppresses the contribution from the leading order tidal phase. So you get something that's going to give you, in the leading order approximation, basically no phase accumulation. The problem is that the leading order approximation breaks down well before you can really confidently say that you have no phase accumulation. So it's sort of a null result, but not a robust one.
Anything else? Can we have a few extra minutes? I guess one last question. So you showed some very nice movies and that show that with the black hole spin, you can get the matter forming the disk, which is obviously the seed ingredient that you need to get GRBs.
Right.
What's the status of understanding the physics basically from there to getting the GRB jet in terms of things like how tightly beamed is it? Is it beamed along the black hole spin direction?
Right.
What type of optical afterglows are there? Light curves, that kind of thing. Is the connection being made there? Yeah.
Well, I can make more of a connection once we have the relevant physics models. No, I mean, we look at, we do a very crude estimate of the disk temperature. Basically, all the heating in our simulations are shock heating. So we only get heat through by means of shocks. But we did perform study of the disk temperature. And the bottom line is we get of order, a temperature of order 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 Kelvin. So if you use approximate scalings, I mean, this is all, you know, going so far out on a limb that you're on the ground already, you know, in 5 seconds. So, but these are approximate scalings from black hole disk simulations, and they predict the gamma ray energies of order 10 to the 47, 10 to the 50 for a typical simulation that we're dealing with. So this is just what we have outside the black hole at the end of the simulation.
So let me ask the more critical question from the LIGO perspective. How do you have an estimate for how tightly beamed the GRB jet would be from the final spin axis of the black hole or the angular momentum axis of the final angular momentum direction of the binary?
No. Not yet. Tune in whenever once we have more physics models, especially magnetic fields.
No, just to add to what Zach was mentioning, yeah, of course, we're very far from making good connections with the gamma ray burst phenomenology, but pretty much every single thing, which is minor, so very far from what you would like to have, is not pointing to something going terribly wrong, i.e. every single little calculation that can be done is very consistent with the fact that either binary black hole neutron stars or binary neutron stars could lead to gamma ray burst. So, the temperatures obtained, the size of the disk. Something we looked into was the fallback mechanism that could explain the sustained emission that about a third of the short gamma ray bursts showed. Also makes sense within the simulations that we have, but we're still pretty far from physics. So far nothing is... Right, so far there is a nice niche of the parameter space that is fairly consistent with what the astrophysicists have been claiming as making sense for their models.
Okay, so if there's no more questions, let's thank Zach again. I believe Abdul is up next with TBD.